Brian for leadiness in those songs. We're again looking in Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments. As we come to the sixth commandment, one writer has said, this is the commandment that no one pleads guilty to. And we may find that that's the case, but we may not this morning. In Hosea chapter 4, Hosea begins that chapter with these words, there is no faithfulness. He's looking at his nation. There is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. There's only cursing, lying, and murder. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed. This could almost be a contemporary description of our land. In the year 2009, we averaged 46 murders per day in our nation. Worldwide, it's even greater. On a worldwide basis, there is one person murdered every minute of every day. Enough people are murdered annually just here in the United States to populate a small city. And we are struggling as a nation and seeing an increase in violent crime. In Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, we read, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man. It's not surprising to find when the law of Moses was ushered in, many years after that passage was written in Genesis chapter 9, that a similar law was given to the people of Israel there, that dealt with the sanctity of human life. It's recorded in Exodus chapter 20, down in verse 13. It's the sixth of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill. In the NIV, it's translated, you shall not murder. Now, there's an important distinction here when we're talking about this word murder here. The Hebrew word literally means the unlawful taking of a human life. Now let me say this, and I want you to understand it. All murder is killing, but not all killing is murder. The law of Moses differentiated between three categories of the loss of human life. The first one is cold-blooded murder. Look for a moment with me over in the book of Numbers, because Numbers really explains in much greater detail the commandments that are given here in Exodus chapter 20. Numbers chapter 35. Down in verse 16, it describes cold-blooded murder and the penalty for it. Numbers 35:16. If a man strikes someone with an iron object so that he dies, he's a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if anyone has a stone in his hand that could kill and he strikes someone so that he dies, he's a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if anyone has a wooden object in his hand that could kill and he hits someone so that he dies, he's a murderer. And the murderer shall be put to death. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. If anyone with malice aforethought shoves another or throws something at him intentionally so that he dies, or if in hostility he hits him with his fist so that he dies, that person shall be put to death. He's a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. So he talks here about the taking of a human life in anger and hostility, a planned event where someone lies in wait and strikes him, and he mentions any number of objects. If he were writing it today, he would say if he has a gun in his hand or a knife in his hand and causes someone to die, he's a murderer. Well, that's one kind of killing, and that's what the law prohibits. You shall not murder. Now, there's another kind of killing that happens. There in chapter 35, verse 22, he goes on and describes an accidental killing. He says in verse 22 of Numbers 35, "But if without hostility someone suddenly shoves another or throws something at him unintentionally or without seeing him, drops a stone on him that could kill him and he dies, then since he was not his enemy and did not intend to harm him, the assembly must judge between him and the avenger of blood according to these regulations. The assembly must protect the one accused of murder from the avenger of blood and send him back to the city of refuge to which he fled. He must stay there until the death of the high priest who was anointed with holy oil." So there is a penalty attached, but it's a protective penalty for one who kills another accidentally. That person's life is not required under the law of Moses. Then he goes on and he describes a killing in self-defense. That's another kind of taking of human life. And that's back in Exodus chapter 22, verse 2, where he talks about that. He says, "If a thief is caught breaking in and is struck so that he dies, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed." Now, under the law of Moses, you could defend your property even to death, and you were not held guilty. That's incidentally not the same in our land today. Now, the sixth commandment that we're looking at here, "You shall not murder," has reference to the first of those types of killing, cold-blooded, premeditated murder. And some people always raise the question, well, what about capital punishment? Well, capital punishment was enacted by God as part of this commandment in response to anyone who murders cold-bloodedly, that their life is to be taken. God had said earlier in Genesis 9:6, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood shall be shed." That was sanctioned under the old covenant by God for a variety of offenses. Now, in the New Testament, we are also told that the government has the right to use the sword. In Romans chapter 13, verses 3 and 4, it says, "For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and he will commend you. For he is God's servant to do you good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer." And so we see that there's an institution that God has placed, especially in the prohibition of the taking of human life, and it requires the blood of man. When we read this sixth commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," it speaks of murder. This commandment is probably one of the most practical and the most needed commandments in the entire list of the ten that we find here. Now, Jesus broadens the meaning in the passage that was read for us at the beginning in Matthew chapter 5. He includes internal feelings of anger and hatred and violence, of malice that we harbor in our hearts. Listen again to what Jesus said. He refers to the sixth commandment and says, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'Do not murder,' and 'Anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.'" That's just what we read. "But I tell you," Jesus said, "that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment." Now, who among us does this not apply to? According to the definition of Moses in the Ten Commandments, I would expect that the majority here could, in all honesty, say, "I have never committed murder." But according to the definition that Jesus gave of the Sixth Commandment, I would be surprised if there was anyone here who could claim innocence in regard to this commandment. You can murder people with your words, with a vengeful attitude, with ill will. Why, racial prejudice would fall under this category. And this commandment is practical today because of what is happening to human life at either end of the spectrum, the very young and the very old. It's interesting because when we began to look in this category of the application of the commandment, the one who really set the moral tone for all physicians who would swear that Hippocratic oath wrote something. Hippocrates lived back in the 5th century B.C., and he really set the moral tone for all who would practice medicine that would follow him, and the Hippocratic oath that's still taken today. I don't know if you've ever read that ethical statement that has become the norm, but this is what Hippocrates said. He said, "I will follow that method of treatment which, according to my ability and judgment, I consider for the benefit of my patients, and abstain from whatever is deleterious and mischievous. I will give no deadly drug to anyone if asked, nor suggest any such counsel. And in like manner, I will not give to a woman a pessary to procure abortion." Hippocrates. You know, in the midst of what is going on in our nation, there's an irony that has developed. It's ironic that in many ways the decline in respect for the sanctity of human life has coincided with the growth in respect of animal rights. Humans going down, animals coming up. And so we have large groups that raise funds to save the baby seals or to save the owls or save the whales. And we do have a stewardship as God's people for the creatures of this earth. But it's interesting that we have a law in our law books. It's the U.S. Code Title 16, Section 668. And this is what it says. Any person who kills, damages, or transports a bald eagle or its egg or its nest is subject to $5,000 fine or imprisonment for up to 1 year or both for the first offense. You damage an unborn eagle, you can be fined $5,000 and go to prison. A teenage girl can destroy the life within her without even notifying her parents. No penalty. Paid for. You know, in Scripture, and I believe that that this commandment applies greatly in this area of the plague of abortion that's taking place across our nation. We sang the song this morning, and I love that song, "God Bless America." And in that song, we ask God to mend our every flaw. We sang and asked God to confirm thy soul in self-control. And it makes me sad in many ways when I sing that song, because I think, boy, what a difference the ideal and the prayer of that song is from the reality that we deal with today. And I want to just talk briefly about the whole situation of abortion. Abortion clashes head on with two fundamental Christian doctrines, which find their origin here in the Old Testament. One is the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. The other is the doctrine of the sanctity of human life. The sovereignty of God says that God alone has the wisdom and the right to make decisions regarding life and death. I do not have the wisdom or the right. I didn't give life, therefore I cannot take life as a human. Job said it right in Job chapter 1, verse 21. The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That is His prerogative and His alone as Creator. The second doctrine, the doctrine of the sanctity of life, has its origin in the very first chapter of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Man is different from all the rest of creation. Man is the only creature made in the image of God. You don't find God's signature on the mountains or on the animals or on the trees, not in the same way that his signature is placed upon us as humans. We alone are made in the image of God. In Psalm chapter 8, verses 3 through 5. The psalmist wrote, "When I consider your heavens and the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him?" He places man in a different category from all these wonders of creation. "The son of man that you care for him, you made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor." Man alone is given this exalted place of privilege among all of creation. The theologian Helmut Thielicke wrote this, "Once a man ceases to recognize the infinite value of the human soul, then all he can recognize is that man is something to be used. But then he will also have to go further and recognize that some men can no longer be utilized, and arrives at the concept that there are some lives that have no value at all." And that's happened. It's increasing. There are countries in this world where the lives of the old and the infirm are shortened. There's an increasing threat in our nation for those who are old and infirm to be disregarded. And it happens at the very earliest stages of life, when an unwanted pregnancy can be viewed as an annoyance, an interference. You know what the difference is between a human embryo in the womb of a mother and the oldest person across the street here in the nursing home? You know what the difference is between those two? Time and nourishment. That's all. In the 139th Psalm, David described that beginning, that work of God within the womb of a mother. And there in the 139th Psalm, down in verse 13, David marveled at God's creative ability. And he wrote, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." Once that seed is fertilized and that life begins to grow, did you know what happens? Only 3.5 weeks after conception, that little heart begins to beat. 4 weeks, only a quarter of an inch long, the head and the body are distinguishable. Between 6 and 7 weeks, the brain begins to function. At 8 weeks, all the limbs are apparent, and the little finger buds are there, and they already have fingerprints on them. Between 9 and 10 weeks, that little child within the womb has the ability to grasp and to suck its thumb. at 13 weeks, at the end of the first trimester, that miniature baby is complete. All it needs to do is grow. Yet there are those who advocate abortion. One strong pro-abortionist, Madeline Sims, writes things like this. She says, "Medically and legally, the embryo and fetus are merely parts of the mother's body and not yet human, like tonsils or tumors. At the moment the egg is fertilized by the sperm, the 23 pair of chromosomes are complete. The child's sex, the child's ultimate size, their shape, the color of their skin, the color of their hair and their eyes, their temperament, their intelligence, all those have been determined already by those chromosomes. Now, the process begins with a single cell there in the womb of the mother. And from that single cell until the time one grows into adulthood, you and I have around 30 billion cells. From one cell to 30 billion cells. And between fusion there in the womb and adult maturity, there are 45 generations of division of these cells. That one cell becomes two, and the two become four, and the four become eight. That happens 45 times. And 41 of those divisions occur before the birth of the child. You know, what makes us a person is not our intelligence. It's not that we know God. What makes us a person is that God knows us. And David said, "You knew me even then." Today, there's a huge argument over what constitutes personhood. Is it at the fetus level, at the embryo level, or is it when the baby has been born? And I think when people argue over that, it's almost like that old argument that Jesus encountered when someone came and said, "Who is my neighbor?" It's an argument used to evade responsibility. I'm convinced that this commandment is probably the most violated commandment of any of the ten. And it's possible that some here this morning may have committed cold-blooded murder. It's possible that some here may have had abortions. I think it's more than possible. I think it's highly probable that every one of us have murdered through ill will or hatred or lack of forgiveness. But let me close this morning by telling you there is good news for anyone who's violated this commandment in any of those categories. Because murder, this is the good news, murder is a forgivable sin. In Micah chapter 7, Micah marveled at God's ability to forgive any sin. He said, "Who is a God like you who pardons sin and forgives the transgression of the remnant of his inheritance? You do not stay angry forever, but you delight to show mercy." God has gone on record. We've got examples here in the scripture. The very man that marveled that God knew him in the womb was a murderer. He was the kind who was a cold-blooded murderer. And God forgave him. And David marveled at the forgiveness of God, that he'd been washed and cleansed of his sin. And there's no sin today. There's not a single sin that's been committed by any one of you that God will not delightedly forgive and cleanse you. If you're not a Christian, if you've never experienced that initial cleansing, let me tell you when it happens. When you put your trust in Jesus, when you acknowledge that you can't do it yourself, but only Jesus can do it, and you trust Him as the one who will save you, and you're willing to turn from those sins and live for Him, when you confess Him, and when you go through those waters of baptism, that initial cleansing takes place. Saul was told, "What are you waiting for? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord." And there is no feeling that's any greater. You can ask any one of these folks here who've been baptized, and they'll tell you what a wonderful feeling. There's been nothing like it since that I've ever experienced in my life. That joy of having my sins washed away. That's the initial cleansing. And then once you're a Christian, when you fall, and you will, when you sin, and you will, that cleansing is available again for the asking. You don't have to go back and be rebaptized every time you make a mistake. All you do is pray to God and ask Him for that forgiveness. And that blood of the Lamb that was applied initially to your soul will be reapplied again and again and again. It's there for the asking. And you're just as clean every time. If you're here today and you need to be cleansed, whether initially or if you need the prayers of God's people for some struggle you have in your life, we want to make this opportunity available to you. And we're going to sing, and we're going to stand, and we invite you to come if you need to.